Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the Dean and Chapter, a very warm welcome indeed to Westminster Abbey for this 27th annual Eric Symes Abbott Lecture. The Very Reverend Eric Abbott was variously Warden of Lincoln Theological College, Dean and Head of Department of King's College London, Warden of Keble College, Oxford, and Dean of Westminster here, and now buried in the Abbey's nave. His influence on students, ordinands, and many others both in the church and beyond was outstanding. And after his death in 1983, a trust was established in his honour to endow these public lectures, which are currently given both here in the Abbey and in Oxford at Keble College. This year's lecture falls at a particularly poignant moment as Eric James, a founding trustee and one of the pivotal members who set this lectureship up, one of Eric Abbott's close friends and certainly well known to some here tonight. Eric James died just this last week, so this evening we honour not only Eric Abbott, but we honour Eric James too. The lectures over the years have addressed key areas of pastoral, spiritual and theological concern, and the subject of this year's lecture is misestablishment, locating and relocating the Church of England. It will be delivered by the Right Reverend Dr. Peter Selby. Bishop Selby's distinguished career has included roles as Vice Principal of the Southwark Ordination Course, Canon of Newcastle Cathedral, Bishop of Kingston upon Thames, William Leach Professorial Fellow in Applied Christian Theology at Durham University. Most recently, he was Bishop of Worcester and Bishop to Her Majesty's Prisons before his retirement in 2007. He's been a member of the Doctrine Commission, President of the Modern Church People's Union, President of the Society for the Study of Theology. He's currently visiting Professor in Theology at King's College London, and from January 2008 became the President of the National Council for Independent Monitoring Boards for Prisons. In all these roles, as both theologian and church leader, he has consistently engaged with issues of justice in key areas of public life. Bishop, we are truly delighted that you're giving this lecture tonight, and we welcome you warmly. And after the Bishop has delivered his lecture, in place of questions from the floor, we're also very pleased that the current Dean of King's College London and current trustee, the Reverend Professor Richard Burridge, will offer a response on all our behalf. And just finally, as usual, if I may, just remind you to turn off all electronic devices which make any noise whatsoever. Thank you very much, Bishop.
Thank you very much. I attended a lecture here last week by Lord Plant, and he was reflecting on the constitutional arrangements around religious faith, and he said that he thought that this was a very appropriate building in which to reflect on that. My word would not actually be appropriate, but dangerous. I am anxious about falling masonry, nonetheless, I'm enormously grateful for the invitation to be here. We have had an additional person to honour this evening, and with your permission, I'd like to add a third to the list that includes Eric Abbott and Eric James. And I do so because one person who was absolutely intending to be here this evening and would have been had he not sadly died yesterday morning was the Reverend Christopher Jones, who was, until his death, one of the policy advisors for the Archbishop's Council. He and I have been friends and colleagues in many situations over many years, and in particular worked very closely together on issues to do with prisons and indeed with the relationship of the Church of England to society generally. So it would be very strange for me not to mention him this evening. We have lost a devout and intelligent priest, and the Archbishop's Council certainly one of its most distinguished servants. Some words which I'm afraid are mine, which I'm quoting to begin. Altering some of the mechanisms at the top of church and state so as to loosen the links a bit will do very little to alter the relationship between the gospel and the people of our land. It will do very little to overcome the alienation of the Church of England from the poorest people of England, or from those who have seen the Church of England as part of their problem rather than part of their solution. So the claims of those seeking change seem to me to be grandiose. On the other hand, those who defend the way things are by referring to the great value of our links with the powerful need to face the question, great value for whom? And when they go on to be concerned lest any modification of the present arrangements might send wrong signals, we need again to ask, wrong signals to whom? End of quote. The honour of the invitation to give this lecture, with the request that I focus on the relationship between church and state, made me realise that the words I wrote some 17 years ago still reflect what I think. The claims on both sides of the disestablishment debate are exaggerated, but the debate continues unabated. The most recent and valuable account of that debate has been the collection of essays, The Established Church, Past, Present and Future. Many of the essays are by historians, and they witness to a discussion that has continued over centuries, focused at different times on different issues, and that even when it might have been expected that the case for disestablishment might prevail, for instance in the aftermath of the prayer book crisis of 1927-28, there has never been really a sufficient head of steam behind the disestablishment case for it to have a real chance of success. More controversially, William White asserts in the concluding essay of that collection that establishment compels both church and state to confront issues that they would each probably rather ignore. This is good for the church, it is probably also good for the state, he says. The same assertion is made by Michael Turnbull and Donald McFadyen in their book, The State of the Church and the Church of the State. They roundly declare that England can only be a society where people can flourish if the Church of England has the confidence in its own vocation to continue to play its role of proclaiming the Jesus imperatives from within the mesh of the nation's institutions. Supporters of disestablishment might well consider the word mesh unintentionally revealing. Certainly, William White, while supporting the maintenance of the challenges and opportunities which establishment offers, asserts that for the future it seems likely that attempts will be made to drive the church and state further apart. I'm glad that we should take the opportunities provided by establishment or by any other aspect of our historical situation. But that must not be at the cost of ignoring what might be some of the effects of the enmeshing, shall I call it, of the Church of England within the state's institutions. There is an analogy here with bodies with which I'm personally engaged, the independent monitoring boards who monitor prisons and immigration detention places. Independent monitoring boards, which exist by law in all places of custody, and with whose national council I work, demonstrate just how difficult it can be to maintain mental independence in the context of having statutory rights of access and representation, and how easy it is to start to think and to speak not of the prison we monitor or the governor whom we question, but of our prison and our governor. I'm suggesting that similar issues arise for an established church. Enmeshed in the state's institutions, will it not start to accept as normal precisely what it should be challenging and embrace uncritically assumptions, some of which should be regarded as most questionable, at the same time defending its own role against some challenges coming from the state, which it should take very seriously. The Church's defence of the bishop's presence in the Lords shows how easy it is to say things that lose touch with the Church's theological task. In their submission of October 2010 to the Joint Committee on the Reform of the House of Lords, the Archbishops declare that, in summary, if, as we believe, the second chamber should remain essentially a revising chamber, and if, as we also believe, the primacy of the House of Commons is to be maintained, the argument that such a chamber can only be effective and have proper legitimacy if it is wholly or mainly elected is no more than an assertion, say the archbishops, on the bishop's behalf. Well, alongside the focus on the functioning of Parliament, are the bishops right to dismiss so summarily the claim that voting gives legitimacy? Can they just dismiss, as no more than an assertion, the principle uniquely enshrined by voting of the equal voice of every person? And is voting something in which the Church in particular can see no value? Surely it is not some post-enlightenment, secularizing, politically correct aberration, but it echoes at the profoundest level Christian convictions about human beings all equally made in the image of God, redeemed by Christ's sacrifice, destined for eternal fellowship with him. I'm not, of course, saying that the archbishops and bishops are not aware of that, only that they chose not to mention the point. Not all would agree that voters are incapable of understanding what might be involved in electing to a revising chamber and how that might differ from election to the Commons. And some might think too much is claimed for the contribution bishops currently make. I couldn't possibly comment. But however that may be, surely the ballot box is a really significant way in which we establish the conviction that in each person is God's image, and for each person there is set aside, as though she were the only one, God's unconditional and self-giving love. That basic theological accountability is often lost in defending the status quo. If the claims for establishment as we now have it seem exaggerated and ignore some of the costs, the case against is not without its exaggerations also. Bishop Colin Buchanan quite properly describes as excursions into fantasy most of the arguments advanced against him when he has spoken for disestablishment. It is, for instance, a bit odd that bishops speak without a hint of embarrassment in favour of the appointment system that just happens to have produced themselves. But that said, there is a difficulty about, as Colin Buchanan puts it, cutting the connection. Establishment is in fact a nexus of connections built up over a very long period and touching on an enormous number of aspects of national life. It would be possible to cut individual connections, the role of the monarch and her ministerial advisers in church appointments, the presence of bishops in the House of Lords, the requirement of parliamentary sanction for measures passed by General Synod, for instance. These are things that could be modified. But the scope and complexity of the connections make the metaphor of cutting a misleading description. What would need to happen is much more like a process of subtle and wide-ranging disentangling. That disentangling involves numerous relationships, local and national, requiring different forms of consent and rearrangement at every point. It is precisely because the disestablishment case appears to require some simple act of severance that at every point, when it appeared that the case for it might gain acceptance, it has not done so. In his essay in The Established Church, Matthew Grimley describes many such moments and much passionate argumentation, but then has to note the way in which the ambitions of the disestablishmentarians foundered on the actual complexity of what would be required. It would, however, be an equal exaggeration to declare the attempts to promote disestablishment a complete failure. Ultimately, as a single revolutionary act, it may be destined to founder on the very English suspicion of revolutions. It is more likely that developments in society as a whole will continue the salami slicing, which, despite what seems at times a pathological defensiveness within the church, has actually altered the shape of establishment at every level. The appointment system gets nearer and nearer to one in which the church has not just a predominant role, but the predominant voice. Ecumenical sensitivities have demanded that effortless Anglican superiority modify itself. And as Elaine Graham chronicles in her essay in the Established Church, the multiculturalism, which for all its occasional turbulence is the context in which we now live, continues to modify what establishment can be. There is every ground for thinking that such incremental change, perhaps decremental would be a better adjective, would be the continuing pattern. Optimistically, perhaps, the last dean of this abbey, Dean Wesley Carr, called this a developing establishment. One day, surely, those who favour disestablishment will be able to wake up and say, establishment? What establishment? That gradual and yet inexorable change might perhaps be illustrated with an example of an area with which I have some familiarity, the established church in the prison service. And this section is called Prisons, a Case Study in Avoidance. On the face of it, prisons and the place of the Church of England within them are a very good example of what Wesley Carr meant in the essay just cited by Earthed Establishment, where the Church of England has a unique and cooperative relationship with the community it serves. That certainly is what the Prison Act of 1952 envisages. Chapter 7 of the Act requires every prison to have a governor, a chaplain, and a medical officer, and that the chaplain and any assistant chaplain shall be a clergyman of the Church of England. These requirements are stated in a matter-of-fact way. You need a governor, a chaplain, and a doctor, note the order, to have a prison. The governor to ensure food and adequate building and no escapes. The chaplain to ensure that prisoners were offered grace and admonition to change their lives. And the doctor to deal with the illnesses which prisoners brought into the prison or contracted there. And the chaplain needs to be a clergyman of the Church of England for the same reason as the doctor needs to be a registered medical practitioner. That's what you need to do the job. This provision is not grounded in some theological view about the superior qualities of Anglicanism, but in an assumption about the established order of things. The institution that could qualify you to be a chaplain was the Church of England. Other churches and other religions might provide visiting ministers who would deal with the needs of their members who were imprisoned, but the chaplain had to have this essential qualification. Now, the Church of England has never pursued the logic of its established position into all areas of life. Oxford and Cambridge might have been barred to you if you were not of the Church of England, but prison was always an experience open to everyone. The inevitable result was and is that prison populations have long since ceased to conform to the shape of the world envisaged by the 1952 Act. Irish Roman Catholics were disproportionately imprisoned, then West Indians and African Pentecostals, now Muslims, and of course other religious groups also. How in these circumstances could you continue the requirement of the 1952 Act? As people started to speak naturally of the Roman Catholic chaplain and the Free Church chaplain, could you continue to speak of the chaplain? And if not, were you to start referring to the Anglican or the Church of England chaplain as though, perish the thought, the church by law established was now just another denomination? And as ecumenical sensitivities increased, and for that we should be grateful surely, the pressure for change mounted. When representatives of other faiths started to carry out their ministry in prisons, and when the Muslim population in particular reached a level where full-time Muslim chaplains were appointed, the question was bound to arise whether the Church of England ascendancy implied by the requirements of the 1952 Act could continue. Now, you might suppose that that would have led to the repeal or amendment of those provisions of the 1952 Act, but not so. No government, nor any head of the prison service, has had any enthusiasm for opening up the prospect of amending the Act. And what has been studied instead is a very classic English remedy. Every prison is still meant to have a person who is legally the chaplain, a clerk in holy orders of the Church of England. But there is also a coordinating chaplain, a person leading the chaplaincy team. And that post is open to people irrespective of their denominational or faith allegiance. It is still the case, I think, that the majority of coordinating chaplain posts are held by Church of England clergy. But this piece of earthed establishment has been allowed gently to modify itself without the ferocious debates that would have ensued within the Church of England between those who would see the Act as a trench worth dying in and those who would welcome the cutting of the connection. During the period I served as Bishop to Prisons, I was the recipient of periodic objections by bishops when a prison in their diocese had a Muslim coordinating chaplain. And some chaplains also found the change difficult. Certainly, the recently retired Chaplain General deserves much credit for bearing the burden and heat of that day to the point where much of the tension around the issue has subsided. But it would have been impossible, surely, to go on requiring coordinating chaplains to be Anglicans without the accusation of gross unfairness. And put positively, and I do put it positively, is it not wholly a good thing that members of chaplaincy teams, Christians of all denominations, as well as ministers deputed by other faith communities, have come to share sufficient levels of understanding of the generic contribution of chaplaincy within an establishment for them to be able to receive from each other and work under whosoever leadership appears appropriate, while maintaining specific provision for the different faith communities? When, as happened some years ago, a Jewish visiting minister can say to me how hurt he was at being told by one of the Church of England chaplains that his services were no longer required at a particular prison because there were no Jewish prisoners there, asserting, "I'm not there just for Jewish prisoners," I felt some embarrassment that he, a Jewish visiting minister, should have grasped that point more than the representative of the established church. Embarrassed, I felt, but I also think it's a very good sign. And this is what happens to establishment when the society within which the church is established changes. It has involved the loss of a certain level of privilege, for sure. But with the loss has come the gain of shared understanding and the building of bridges. If the believers in establishment are serious in that belief, they should not be surprised if the day should come when establishment passes into history having done its job. If establishment was a response to a new historical moment, whether under Constantine or Elizabeth I, there is no reason to suppose that new responses will not be required in the unfolding history of a globalized world and a society of exciting variety and religious diversity. No doubt skirmishes about various aspects of establishment will continue, and certainly there are issues of principle in the development of society where the religious, not just Christians, will wish to enter strong arguments. But the place of the established church itself will surely continue to diminish. We are dealing here with historical developments, all of which point in the same direction. Those who advocate the maintenance of the status quo will be as disappointed by these developments as those who insist that with one bound we could be free. The preoccupation with that debate prevents us from noticing some far more significant developments. And it's to these that I devote the rest of what I have to say. And the first section is called Establishment and Sovereign Power. Establishment historically has to do with the relationship between the church and sovereign power. Sovereign power may be exercised by a monarch, and the place of the Church of England in relation to the monarchy hardly needs mention in a lecture given in this abbey. The sovereign was an absolute monarch and is now a constitutional one. Sovereignty is exercised now through parliamentary democracy. As Parliament has developed, so has its interaction with the Church of England. But despite these developments, no examination of establishment can avoid considering the nature of sovereign power itself. What is this to which the established church claims a special relationship? As analysed in the thinking of Giorgio Agamben, the central feature of sovereign power is that it has and is vitae necisque potestas, the power of life and death. In the modern state, sovereign power has become power over bare life. This isn't an abstract point. Consider the capacity of large numbers of people to house themselves and their families, to feed themselves, to be treated in the event of bodily illness, to find basic education for their children, to obtain productive employment. For all citizens of the state to some degree, and for the poorest citizens to an ever-increasing degree, the state's power over bare life, the power of life and death, continues to grow. Thus, politics becomes biopolitics. The sovereign has overwhelming power over bare bodily existence. I want to stress the point. The issue here is not the processes by which sovereign power has been exercised. It would be a great mistake to suppose that the character of sovereign power has changed simply because the mechanisms of constitutional government or democratic elections are in place. As we shall see, the opposite can be the case. For while the sovereign is without question part of the juridical order of the society, with rights and duties constitutionally prescribed, the sovereign also has the capacity to define the boundaries of the constitutional order. That is, the sovereign has the right to declare status exceptionis, a state of exception. It is of the essence of sovereignty that it is defined by its capacity to decide the exception. And it is the exception, as Kierkegaard puts it, that tells you what sovereignty is. The exception explains the general and itself. And when one really wants to study the general, one need only look around for a real exception. It brings everything to light more clearly than the general itself. Describing sovereignty in terms of the right to declare an exception points to the sovereign's right to declare the subject excluded from the society. Sovereign power thus shows itself in things like the right to imprison, to section under the Mental Health Acts, or to deprive a person of citizenship or the right of residence. It is unfortunately a fact of history that examples of the exercise of this sovereign power to exclude and ultimately to kill are not hard to find. They demonstrate all too clearly that particular constitutional arrangements for the exercise of sovereign power are far from being a guarantee against the placing of individuals and groups under bans of various kinds. What is important, however, is that the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century are considered not simply as the singular extremisms of particular countries and times, but are seen in the light of the development of precisely those institutions which were thought to liberate people from the sovereign's uncontrolled power. In particular, it would be important not to see democracy, the sovereignty of the people, as some kind of guarantee against exceptional and extreme exercises of sovereign power. In fact, democratic institutions, based as they are on the belief that popular power will be the best defense of popular interests against the power of those who direct armies or have the control of most of the wealth, have proved easy prey, those democratic institutions, have proved easy prey to those able to engage the sympathies of the populace against vulnerable groups of many kinds. To engage the people, it is only necessary to persuade or seduce them into believing that those with power and wealth are their best protection against groups who are presented as the greatest danger to their prosperity or even their very safety. When politics embraces bare life, sovereign power becomes even more secure and less subject to control. The sovereign is able to designate particular individuals and groups as presenting an enormous risk to the security of the state or to the prosperity and well-being of the people, and therefore as not deserving the protections citizens are meant to enjoy. There are echoes here of the ancient warnings about Hebrew kingship, a kingship created also in response to the will of the people, albeit a will not expressed by voting. The people are warned that the king will take their sons for his armies and their daughters as cooks, perfumers, and bakers. They are warned that the best produce of the land will be taken for the king's purposes. And then in words that echo much of the history of chosen sovereigns, you will cry out because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. So it was that the river of biopolitics, the progressive concern of sovereign power with bare life, came together with the plan of 20th century totalitarian states for total domination, working itself out in the concentration camps. As Hannah Arendt puts it, the concentration camps are the laboratories for the experiment of total domination. For human nature being what it is, this goal can only be achieved under the extreme certain circumstances of human-made hell. It is profoundly disturbing to note the development of concentration camps by the Spanish in their colonization of Cuba at the end of the 19th century, and by the British in their dealings with the Afrikaners at the same time. In both cases, the needs of the colonists resulted in the declaration of a state of exception, effectively of martial law. By the time such a state of exception was declared within the Nazi state to provide the basis for the camps, it was not even necessary to make an open declaration of a state of exception as such, so much had the extreme situation become part of the normal operation of the state. In its courageous statement on war responsibility, the Synod of the Nippon Seiko Kai, the Japanese province of the Anglican Communion, makes a number of similar points about the rule of the Tenno, the Japanese emperor. In identifying the idolatry inherent in the Tenno system, the statement points also to its inherent imperialism and racism, in which obedience to the God of Heaven or King of the Universe is validated by an interior obedience on the part of the subjects, who identify their interests and their destiny with the power of the sovereign. Coming nearer home, such formal idolatry is avoided in the tradition of sovereignty as exercised in English history. But that formal avoidance does not counter the point that sovereign power as exercised domestically and then exported is indeed sovereignty over bare life. The prayer for the sovereign in the Holy Communion service of the Book of Common Prayer is that she, knowing whose minister she is, may above all things seek thy honour and glory. The formal idolatry is avoided by the clause, knowing whose minister she is. However, the balancing clause contains the more important petition, and that we and all her subjects, duly considering whose authority she hath, may faithfully serve, honour, and humbly obey her in thee and for thee, according to thy blessed word and ordinance. The elegant rhetorical symmetry presented by these two clauses cannot conceal the serious and deliberate imbalance of substance. The prayer that worshippers offer for the sovereign is counterbalanced by the assertion of divine authority and scriptural backing for the obedience of the subjects. It hardly needs adding that what is asked of the subjects is subject to enforcement, as those who belonged to different Christian allegiances or lands later colonized found out only too well. Sadly, the river of biopolitics flows on, as those dependent on the state for bare life experience the effect of changed policies for welfare and public provision. As this paper was being written, a London landlord was reported as declaring that the evictions he needed to seek because of caps on housing benefit would amount in their effects to ethnic cleansing. The disproportionate incarceration of members of poor and disadvantaged groups and minority ethnic communities witness to the same point. Both the welfare regime and the increased use of imprisonment show what sovereignty actually means and provide the threatening context within which all of us pass our lives. To be established is to be closely related to that exercise of sovereignty as coercive power over bare life. Much more to the point than most current debates about the ending of the mechanics of establishment was Donald MacKinnon's hope that the ending of establishment see an end to episcopal blessings on Polaris submarines. Unfortunately, there is no particular evidence that when churches are disestablished, they become less eager to have a share in sovereign power, as the disestablished religious right in the USA and its addiction to military force, capital punishment, and imprisonment on a massive scale make all too clear. So more serious than any question about any limits on the church's ordering of its own life in exchange for certain privileges in the life of the nation is whether the church is established in relation to sovereign power or in relation to those who are the victims of the exercise of that power. In those situations where a choice has to be made between the claims of sovereign power and the claims of the excluded, where is the church located? My next section takes this into a different area and is called Sovereign Power and the Role of Money. Posters advertising this, The Spectator, on the London Underground recently expressed in chilling terms the current nature of sovereign power. Most Germans own a second property, the poster proclaims. Greece. The reality of sovereign power as it is exercised in a nation, Greece, which just happens to be the cradle of European democracy, is that while the outward structures might indeed be more or less in place, and I suppose if I'd written this today I might not even have said that, rule of quite a different kind is being exercised, even if not with the violent brutality that we associate with the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century. But from the point of view of the Greek people, and especially of its poor, any suggestion that their democracy exercises sovereignty in their country can only elicit a hollow laugh. But this is just one instance of a developing trend towards the exercise of sovereign power by the quantity and controlling strength of money and those who hold or manipulate it. Before the collective might, even of a failing banking system, the government of nation states, even the largest nation states, are helpless. Too big to fail means too powerful to control. This is not the place, nor is there the time, to give a full account of the way in which sovereign power has passed to those who have control or manipulate money. But of the reality of the passing of sovereign power, we can surely be in no doubt. The authority to create money was in time past no different from the authority to raise an army. It was a sovereign act. The passing of that power, the power to create money, virtually unchallenged, to bank boardrooms, is a passing of sovereign power. And it is sovereign power over bare life. The power of such institutions, virtually to determine the economic policies of elected governments, means that those receiving, or no longer receiving, welfare payments do so at the behest of unelected bodies. Those who sit on juries, deciding in effect whether a person might be consigned to custody, will increasingly know that the good of the economy, at least of their pension funds, will in part be related to those whose prosperity depends on the prisons they buy, build, and manage. And as the dislocation in the world economy grows greater, more and more people will be driven to migrate in search of the essentials of bare life, and immigration policy will more and more be structured to maintain the standard of living of those who already have, consigning hundreds of thousands to a state of exception, the status of banned persons. Why mention these changes in the way sovereignty is exercised? Because sovereign power, as it is now exercised, bear no signs of the establishment of the Church of England. Bishops may sit in the legislature, the monarch may take an oath before God, but the church will be the last body to be involved in decisions about investment, interest rates, the money supply, and so forth. I'm not suggesting that the church should have a place on the governing body of the Bank of England. I'm only pointing out that in debates about the privileges and duties of establishment, our involvement with sovereignty is with sovereignty as it was and not as it is. We are misestablished. And wisdom and faithfulness begins with that recognition, and therefore with abandoning any overestimate of the significance of our relationship with the old order. These relations may give opportunity for marginal effects on what government does, on legislation, on the institutions of civil society. To take these opportunities is perfectly proper, as it is to resist points when the duties associated with those relationships become irksome. But overall those activities is a warning sign that reads, "This night your soul will be required of you." Crisis, the point of judgment, comes when sovereign power, vitae nequisque potestas, the power of life and death, is actually exercised, when persons are made, economically or by the use of force, non-persons. At that point, the decision is whether to side with sovereign power or with the victims of its use, even at the cost of the relationship enjoyed with the outward sources of sovereign power, the monarch or parliament. And to take this one step further, my next section is called Empire, Sovereignty Sans Frontières. This shift in sovereign power is not simply a national phenomenon. Nation-states have less and less capacity to act as though they could exercise independent sovereignty. The globalization of the market economy means that international finance determines more and more policies and outcomes over which nations have less and less control. And the scale of the global economy means that a dominant individual national economy can exercise enormous influence over the economies of other nations, and particularly over the poorest. What we have seen, and shall continue to see more and more, is the mutation of sovereignty into empire, sovereignty exercised without frontiers. Unlike the empires of old, this empire is not the result of successful national imperialism, but of financial power, supported by force where necessary, but mostly exercised through the operation of the market, by the will of those with the most power to act there. As Hart and Negri put it in their book Empire, they say, "The passage to empire emerges from the twilight of modern sovereignty. In contrast to imperialism, empire establishes no territorial centres of power and does not rely on fixed boundaries or barriers. It is a decentred and deterritorializing apparatus of rule that progressively incorporates the entire global realm within its open, expanding frontiers." What this comes to mean for sovereign states, they sum up bluntly. Today, a notion of politics as an independent sphere of the determination of consensus and a sphere of mediation among conflicting social forces has very little room to exist. Consensus is determined more significantly by economic factors such as the equilibria of the trade balance and speculation on the value of currencies. In terms of the topic we're examining today, we can be clear that the Church of England will be established only in that little room. In that space, some differences can be made, and my purpose is not to minimize them. But in terms of the relationship of church to sovereign power, these massive economic changes mean that we are fundamentally misestablished. So we have to notice what such shifts in the location of sovereignty mean, not most importantly to us as church, but to those most deeply affected by the vitae nequisque potestas, the power of life and death, that now belongs to those who have power in the market. The world's poorest populations may be taught to attribute their famine and disease to decisions made by their own government in the exercise of its sovereignty, or they may assume they're part of the givenness of their lives, rooted in climatic conditions or other matters beyond human control. No doubt these elements play a part. But in the main, and with the perspective of our examination of sovereign power over bare life, the reality is that the power of those who control money in the wealthiest countries has declared a state of exception over the majority of humankind, and also gained the right to determine the law under which trading relations and consequent relations of credit and debt exist. As with most exercise of sovereign power, it is natural for the powerful to be convinced that the course of action they take is also the most beneficial, not just for them, but for those whose destiny they are deciding. They live under the closing sentence of Jesus' comment on the disciples' dispute about which of them is to be the greatest. The kings of the nations lord it over them, and those in authority are called benefactors. The laws of the market that declare various states of exception and call them beneficial have much wider effects too. The global market has the potential to govern the whole environment of a society, its provision of health care and its educational system, its legal apparatus and criminal law, and in the last resort also those areas of people's lives which are at the same time declared to be private. Michael Sandel's latest book asks, with numerous examples to back up his case, what, if anything, is left that money can't buy? You'll see a flyer on some of your seats about a discussion of that. There are, I don't deny, far more positive things to be said about globalization than that it causes the most vulnerable people and nations to be excluded from human flourishing. From the standpoint of a Christian tradition which speaks again and again of the determination of God, that God's love should be shared to the ends of the earth, we should not place ourselves among those who simply grumble about globalization. There has been and continues to be a sharing of democratic institutions and the rule of law, ideals of solidarity and inclusion. If these appear increasingly without the direct exercise of power by churches, they do nonetheless appear. The fact that the Church of England, like churches in many countries, no longer has its hands on the levers of power and influence should not stand in the way of our rejoicing in the good when we see it. At the same time, we face a challenge to respond to those whom the benefits of a global market pass by, and those who more seriously are reduced to the status of non-persons by its onward march. So, in conclusion, the call to relocation. The claims for establishment and the defensiveness in the face of change seem to me exaggerated, and the claims for disestablishment likewise. Both sides in that debate also ignore the fact that the processes of attrition which have already diminished establishment will certainly continue and contain much that is good and hopeful. In the process, there are new and exciting things to be learned, and from time to time what we deem to be destructive aberrations to be challenged after we've considered the case. Such an environment is challenging, but to a people who are heirs to the promise of the Spirit who leads into all truth, surely it's not to be seen as regrettable. It is, after all, in the truth that we seek to be established. Perhaps one byproduct of the history of establishment that we do need to lose is a tendency to combine a negative reaction to change with a lack of forthrightness about real injustice. But above all else, I have sought to draw attention to an aspect of establishment that is absolutely central but frequently overlooked, namely that it is about a relationship with the sovereign. The sovereign as holder of the power to declare states of exception, specifically to exercise increasing power over the bare life of the subject, to lock up, to exclude, and to grant or refuse basic rights of survival, is the one with whom an established church is in relation. That being so, what has caused the church to be misestablished is the historic change to the location of sovereign power, from the structures of the nation state to those who have control over the operation of the market. A debate about whether to change the relationship of the church to the nation ignores the more challenging issue of the church's relation or non-relation to the market. It is there that the policies of nation states are determined, there that people are reduced to poverty or otherwise excluded from the mainstream of society. A consideration of that misestablishment has therefore to lead to a reconsideration of the church's location. That reconsideration needs to take seriously the absence of any effective relationship with the sources of financial power or those principally experiencing poverty and exclusion. It is further demanded, as I have suggested, by the international character of those current sources of sovereign power, determining as they do the operation of a globalized market. We are not at liberty to ignore that historical development or simply to bemoan it. The divine project has always been and is now a global one, and there is too much on offer and too much at stake for us to neglect the opportunities or the challenges of that globalization. But as things are, the church is perceived, and accurately so, as lacking both the determination and the skill to engage those who operate in the globalized financial marketplace, and at the same time the willingness to act in solidarity with those whom the international market subjects to states of exception. To remedy that is to embark on the reform of our discipleship, and that's always a more challenging and demanding task than debating or even executing changes in our institutional arrangements. But the combination of the disturbances of last summer, the explosion of frustration at the market's exercise of sovereign power represented by the Occupy movement, and the evidence that financial sector professionals do not believe that the church has any useful ethical guidance to offer, these and many other signs leave us no choice, if we are to be faithful, than to seek to relocate ourselves in relation to that sovereign power, its controllers and its victims. And what really leaves us no choice is that we profess that the one who resisted sovereign power to the point of becoming its victim is the one to whom sovereignty ultimately belongs. Thank you.
As the chairman of the Eric Symes Abbott Trust, it falls to me to conclude this evening with some words of thanks. I first want to begin with a very heartfelt thank you to Canon White, who, in the absence of the Dean, introduced tonight's lecture so beautifully and has overseen it. Canon White, as well as being the canon theologian here at Westminster Abbey, is also a visiting professor at King's College London. So in his own person, he symbolises Dean Eric Symes Abbott. And I'm delighted that we were able to vote him on as a new trustee of the Eric Abbott Trust in our meeting earlier. But of course, supremely, it's thanks to Bishop Peter. He is himself a King's man in his PhD, as well as a visiting professor at King's. And so therefore, a worthy successor to stand here in this House of Prayer, where Dean Eric Abbott presided for so many years, to challenge us afresh. And in that hard-hitting and clear lecture, I believe he has done so. The purpose of this response is to say thank you on behalf of everyone, and to pay Bishop Peter the additional compliment of some dialogue or debate with, in lieu of questions, of one or two of the areas. And I want to comment briefly on his title, on the four main points of his lecture, and in his conclusion, and to do so all in 5 minutes. We asked him in this year of the Queen's Jubilee to reflect upon the establishment between the relation between church and state. And he gave us this interesting title with the word misestablishment, and then the shift from disestablishment to misestablishment, a term I don't think I properly understood on my first read through. But it was his subtitle, Locating and Relocating the Church of England, that made me think about the dislocation of the church in society, its mislocation, and that appeal at the end for relocation. Because I am sure he's right that the traditional debates for and against establishment and disestablishmentarianism, and the fact that, of course, it's the longest word in the English language, anti-disestablishmentarianist, I'm sure he's right that they miss the point. The relationship between church and state is one of, as he put it, enmeshing. And over my lifetime, and certainly the lifetime of this sovereign, we have seen a disentangling of church and state. But it is a very curious web. And so to explore Bishop Peter's thesis about location and dislocation and relocation, he took us through four areas. The first, of prisons, of course, I must pay tribute to his work here in prisons for many, many years. And his case study of chaplaincy rings true to me in my work within universities. The assumption, the easy assumption of 1952 of the establishment, and the change is we've grown into a multi-faith society. My question to him here would be that he didn't mention the word ecclesiology. And that is beautifully exampled by the story he told us about the assumption that the chaplain would be Church of England to the Jewish chaplain who said, I'm not just there for Jewish prisoners. It is, I think, at the heart of our understanding of what it means to be an established church, that our ecclesiology means we are there for everyone, members or not. And in my own debates as senior chaplain, first in a university in the West Country and then as Dean of King's, as we have expanded our chaplaincy team, was to recognise the different ecclesiologies of some of my other partners who saw themselves as the chaplain to brand X students. And sometimes when I said, no, I want you to be the brand X chaplain to the university, I was then accused of Anglican imperialism, of imposing my ecclesiology upon them. I don't see why I should go and visit that student. After all, he's not Catholic or Baptist or Jew or whatever. I am delighted that so many of my colleagues in chaplaincy in the universities and in prisons and in hospitals have moved to saying, I'm not just there for those of my members. The paradox and the challenge to the Church of England has been that as other faith communities have moved towards an ecclesiology, you've seen that they're there for everyone. The Church of England is increasingly moving towards a separatist and congregationalist ecclesiology of seeing itself just for its members. The second area that he took us into of sovereign power and power over life of death, and the way in which certainly disestablishment doesn't stop people wanting to bless weapons and so on, I think reflects also on Bishop Peter's comments about the House of Lords. For me, part of the debate about the role of bishops in the House of Lords goes back to what I was saying about being there for everyone. It is because of the parish system, which means that every blade of grass and every person, whether or not they're a member of the church, have a legal right to call upon the ministry of the church in baptisms, weddings and funerals and so on. And that again, therefore, takes us to the question of who we are here for. Is it everyone or just our members? But Bishop Peter then took us into money, another crucial area of his work. And when I wrote this response, I referred to his very interesting and important book, Grace and Mortgage. And I was delighted, therefore, when I walked in tonight to see there's a large pile of them available for sale at the back of the Abbey. And in his reflections on the banking crisis and the Occupy movement, he asked the question how little we are consulted by big business. Interestingly, I had the privilege to succeed Bishop Peter as the deputy chair of the Ethical Investment Advisory Group of the Church of England. And it's been very interesting to look in the post-Occupy crisis, the letter from the church commissioners in the Daily Telegraph appealing to churches and charities and other investors to use their power as investments to block high and excessive remuneration for chief executives and excessive bonuses. The resulting power of all those who signed that letter in the Daily Telegraph was $1.5 trillion of investments. And of course, we have seen what is now being called the stakeholder spring, as these packages are being increasingly turned down, led, amazingly, by the Church of England. It's a little sign, but one I hope of actually that relocation to where sovereign power now is, and a preparedness to get our hands dirty. But lastly, Bishop Peter was quite right to say it's globalisation sans frontier, this huge shift. I've just returned from lecturing my way around the world and was very struck by the buoyant economies of China and India, where they've just downgraded their growth forecasts to things that are many, many, many times our wildest dreams. And yet even there, the Asia Bank report points out the vast and growing gap of rich and poor. And therefore the need to who will speak for the poor in the Far East as well as here. If we are to be more than just a church for our members or a society for those who pay their dues, it is that relocation to be on the side of the poor that Bishop Peter has drawn our attention to. So in his conclusion, and I thought the call to relocation was a much preferable word than a call to re-establishment, the relocation of the church as a national body with its parish system to speak for all and not just for its own is absolutely crucial. And that leaves us with the challenge facing the Church of England at the moment when we want to discuss mission so much. Is it about outreach to serve our nation in prisons and hospitals, parishes and schools, or in drag just to get more members for our congregations? And if that relocation is service to all in the name of Christ, Bishop Peter has also been right to talk about the relocation of our relationship to the sovereign. And of course, one institution which has been itself dislocated and relocated over the last 60 years has been Her Majesty the Queen and the Crown. And it would be right to pay tribute to the way in which she herself has continued to serve both church and nation throughout that time. But Peter has directed our attention to the shift of sovereign power to international money, globalised markets. And if the church is to relocate to meet this challenge in the post-Occupy world, we will need to get our hands dirty, to get involved with debates of stockholders and shareholders' meters, and so on. And that, I think, would be a very fitting legacy to the challenge that Bishop Peter has set before us tonight, and indeed to the legacy left to us by Eric Abbott. Before I ask you once more to express your appreciation of Bishop Peter's lecture, can I just, as well as plugging his book, Grace and Mortgage at the back, remind you that copies of tonight's lecture, the full text, which is certainly, I'm sure you agree, bears constant study and rereading, are available at the back for you tonight, as well as copies of previous lectures, if you wish to purchase those. And the mailing list for this lecture, you all should find on your seat, as well as the flyer about the Sandel debate with Bishop Peter, advance notice of next year's lecture on the 2nd of May. Dame Averil Cameron, formerly Warden of Keble College, Oxford, and one of the trustees of the Eric Abbott Trust, who we continue to reflect on church and state, as reflected in the anniversary of the conversion of Constantine and the Christianization of the Roman Empire, or for that matter, the effect upon the church, which will, I think, pick up what Peter has been saying for us tonight beautifully. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please join me in once again thanking Bishop Peter for a fabulous lecture.